We're doing Mishlei. We're up to what's called the sixth chapter, the 17th Pasuk. Shlomo HaMelech had said in the previous Pasuk, Sheshena Sane Hashem, V'sheva Tovat Nafsho. There are six things that God hates, and the seventh, God deplores, God finds despicable. Einayim Ramot Leshon Shaker, V'yadayim Shofichot Dam Naki. Einayim Ramot, eyes that are haughty. Einayim, eyes, Ramot, that are lifted up, that are haughty. People who look down at other people. So, there are two ways in which a person can walk down the street or can behave ordinarily. There are people who are always looking down, and then there are people who are always looking up. And I don't know if you guys ever had a teacher who spoke to you this way in class, but I did. And it was a very interesting experience sitting in a classroom with a teacher talking like this. So in Tanakh, very often a person that talks like this, but their eyes looking at the ceiling all the time, is called a haughty person. Einayim Ramot, their eyes are up. They don't look people in the eye. They're always looking at what we call today, his nose is in the clouds. I don't know if you guys ever saw someone walking like this. You guys ever see that? The Talmud in Kiddushin discusses the different ways in which different professionals walk. Depending on the profession a person has, the level of haughtiness, how high his nose is in the clouds. So the Talmud discusses this. The tendency of people when they're confident in their position or for whatever other reason, they can be haughty. So the Pasuk says, number one on God's hate list is Einayim Ramot, someone who's haughty. Leshon Shaker, number two is a person who lies. Leshon Shaker, a deceitful tongue. Number three, V'yadayim Shofichot Dam Naki, hands that spill clean blood. So, question here is this all one person? Is this three different attributes? If it's three different attributes, then it's a little difficult, because what's the ordering here? I would think murder should come first. Okay. Lev Choresh Machshevot Avin Raglaim Mimaharot Larutz Lara'a. So number four and five, Lev Choresh Machshevot Avin, someone who focuses his heart to think of sin. You have a person that sins, then you have a person who focuses and keeps thinking how he could do it. That's one of the things that God hates. Lev Choresh Machshevot Avin, one whose thoughts are always thinking deeply how to hurt others, how to do sin. Raglaim Mimaharot Larutz Lara'a, and feet that are rushing to do evil, to do bad. Again, it's not only the evil that one does, it's also the rushing to do evil. Pasuk Yutet, Yafiach Kezavim Eid Shaker, one who speaks lies and testifies falsely. Umshaleach Midanim Bein Achim, and one who arouses a quarrel between two people that have a good relationship. So if you have brothers or friends and someone comes and says something that causes a rift between them, that's the big number seven that God says is worse than all the others. Here again, you have to understand what's the pasuk talking about. How could that be worse than murder? So maybe murder over here is not doesn't mean literally murder. Maybe it means shaming a person. I don't know. But at any rate, it's coming to tell us the great weight for he who causes quarrels, Mishalech Medanim Ben Achim. He who causes fights among brothers, he who causes fights among friends, that God says is absolutely revolting before him, and that's the seventh, that's even worse than the other six. So, if the Chazal tell us that when a person says Lashon Hara and he causes fights between others, it's like he's killing three people. He's killing the person he spoke about, he's killing the person who hears the Lashon Hara, and he's killing himself. So that's what Chazal say about Lashon Hara. Shlomo continues, Netzor benim mitzvat avihicha ve'al titosh torat imecha. Son, watch over your father's commandment and don't leave what your mother has taught you. So here I think I often say that Shlomo HaMelech in this pasuk, and this is a pasuk that repeats itself throughout Mishlei in different forms, Shlomo is telling us the difference between the education a father gives and the education a mother gives. Al titosh torat imecha, Chazal learned from that our responsibility to maintain minagim. What's the difference between a father and a mother? Father instructs, do this, don't do that. His teachings are far more direct. The mother, that's not the way you sit, that's not the way you should do that. It's more about a way of life. A father, his teachings are more often, also the way in which men approach things is more head on. And the mother, like the Talmud says, "Meshadalto b'dvarim," she convinces him. She finds ways to get him to do it. It's less confrontational. At the end of the day, we have both with us. A person grows up; he knows what did his father tell him. His father always said, "Eat a good meal in the morning." His father always said, "Do business honestly." But deep down in the way he lives his life, his habits, his nature, is what his mother's ingrained in him. That's called Torat Imecha, the mother's Torah. And that's why the Pasuk says, watch what your father told you, and don't leave what your mother told you. Because what your mother told you, those are things that are going to be a part of you. You have to actively alter course in order to remove them. Those are things that become a part of a person. You guys know there's a famous book, Everything I Need to Learn, I Learned in Kindergarten. You know the book, Brownlee. So there are a lot of things that are habits that we form as children. And they're things that our mother instills in us. Our mother, who's home with us in a traditional home, she's home with the kids most of the day. The father's home part of the day. But the father's directions are more confrontational. They're more head-on. And so a person might remember, my dad always told me this, that, or the other thing, but he'll have to keep asking himself and have to keep reminding himself, let me watch over the way my father taught me. Whereas what the mother teaches us, that's a part of us. A kid asks his mother, why do we wear Shabbos clothing on Shabbos? Why do I have to wear Shabbos shoes, a white shirt, and blue pants on Shabbos? So the mother says, son, I don't know. I don't know Shulchan Aruch, I don't know Gemara, but this is what Jews do. Wear those clothing. So after a few times, the kid does it. He doesn't think about why. It becomes a part of him. A kid wears a yarmulke. Why do I have to wear a yarmulke, Ma? I don't know. It's what Jews do. Wear the yarmulke. Okay, fine. After a few times, the kids get used to it. It becomes a part of you. Very often the mother doesn't have an answer. She didn't learn the Talmud and everything else. She just knows this is what being Jewish is all about. And that sticks. And it becomes a part of us. Shlomo HaMelech says, "Al titosh Torat imecha." Don't leave your mother's Torah. And you know what? This pasuk is the source for minhagim in Am Yisrael. How come we adhere to customs? There isn't a verse. There isn't a rabbinic institution, but there's a custom. Rabbi Gamliel's sons went to town. It was Friday afternoon. They went to mikveh. The people of the town told them, two brothers don't go into mikveh together. They stepped outside and respected the minhag. They went in one at a time. Where they came from, there was no such minhag. There's no halacha like that. Two brothers can go into mikveh at the same time. But in this town, that was the custom. They respected it. Go figure why there's a custom. So there are many customs. We respect them. And if Rabbi Gamliel's sons would have, if they wanted to be smart Alex, they would have said, where does it say? We learned Talmud. We're the sons of the prince. We know Mishnah and Talmud. There's no such minhag anywhere. In this town there's such a minhag. That's a minhag. A minhag is something, that's what my mother told me. And when I asked her why, she didn't necessarily know why. But that's what we do, so that's what we do. It's very powerful, the strength of a minhag. Al titosh torat imecha. Shlomo HaMelech says it's within you. You just got to make sure not to leave it. this brings up a point which should concern you guys. Very often a chozer b'tshuva wants to date a chozeret b'tshuva. And that's a good thing because you have similar experiences and you can understand one another better and you can understand your ups and downs better, but you have to realize that this pasuk is going to be hard on you. Al titosh torat imecha is going to be hard to live by because what you know is what you've learned in the mitzvat avicha. You've learned externally, you've learned the information. But what about living a Jewish life? What about a white tablecloth on the Shabbos table? Doesn't say it anywhere. What about the fact that a mother-in-law buys her daughter-in-law candlesticks for the wedding? Doesn't say it anywhere. There are a lot of things that are just the way Jews live, and it doesn't say it anywhere. And those things, a girl that grew up in a frum home, even if she wasn't the top girl in the class, she knows this is what life's about. This is what my father did. This is how we do it. I'll give you a small example. When we got married, so the first Shabbos we got to be at home, so I'm a little bit hard-pressed. This is the first time I'm running a Shabbos table. So everything I'm doing, and my new wife is obviously looking at everything I'm doing, so I'm thinking, what is it saying, Halacha, what should I do this, what should I do there? We wash, and comes time to say Hamotzi. So I sit down to say Hamotzi, and I take the cover off the chalas. Then I remember the Mishnah Brewer brings an opinion, you should leave the cover on the chalas when you make Hamotzi. So I'm sitting there thinking, Mishnah Brewer says this, and I think to do that. Years later, I found out that it's the Yekish custom to take the cover off the chalas when you make the Hamotzi. And the reason it was natural for me to take the cover off was because that's what my father always did. I didn't think about it. When I started thinking about it, then I said, wait a second, but the Mishnah Brewer brings an opinion, it's better to leave the cover on. So I called my father and I asked him, what do you do? He said, I take the cover off. So when I asked my father why, my father came up with a bunch of reasons that I didn't like. So I said, okay, so I'm not doing that. Years later, I discovered that really, that's the custom that Yekis, Germanic Jews, that's the custom we have. I had a guest, a girl from a Germanic home, and I decided to take advantage of that. I asked her. She said, sure, my father takes the cover off. And I know her father is a stickler on menhagim. He wouldn't do a thing different than what his father did. And then I realized, okay, so my father has good reasons, but at the end of the day, the real reason is because that's what he saw his father do. So then I went back to taking the cover off and making that motzi. But these are things that you don't think about. When it came time for me to do it, I'd never thought about it before. And I could give you many other minhagim that way. That should be in a person's blood. That's the way he grew up. That's something you have to think about. And that's a certain advantage to marrying a girl that comes from a frum home. If you don't have that, you at least have to try to become a ben bayit in a frum home. You have to try to find a home where you become a part of the home. And that means you take out the garbage. You don't just come and be a guest. If you want to be a part of the family, then being a part of the family means you partake in the things that are less pleasant than being part of the family. They might not want you in the kitchen doing the dishes, but you have to figure out how to do it. When Chazal tell us that Hagar, her father told her, better be a maid in the house of Avram than be a princess in my house, he was on to something. She was better off. Look at what happened. She became all of Yishmael. She became all the great tribes of Midian, Be'efa, Vachanoch, Avidah, Ve'eldah. She had so many children from Avram. She became a great part of the world. A large part of the world are descendants of Hagar. And Paro told her, go be a maid in their home and get close to Avram. You'll get close to them. I often say, when I had a chance, I used to go and take out the garbage for Mordechai Leo. I used to come to him with questions, and when I came with questions, I'd also ask if I could take out the garbage. So, of course, his wife refused, and I insisted, and sometimes I won. But you know what? Even from the walk, from the doorway to taking out the garbage, I learned things. There are things you learn, and when you... Okay, so I'm not saying you should go to the chief rabbi of Israel and take out the garbage, but you should find a frum family where you could be a ben bayit, and I say the same thing for the girl, the female listeners to this. It's important. Go and help in the kitchen. You know, you guys, I don't think they'll let you into the kitchen. But the girls should at least get into the kitchen and get used to things and learn what a Jewish kitchen is all about. Guys often ask me, the girl I'm dating, she only went to seminary for this number of years. And I say that's not the key point by me. The key question, if she's going to know how to run a Jewish home, is what kind of home did she grow up in? And was their home that she became a part of, so that she knows the norms. And a lot of it is norms. We can't work based on a textbook. That's one of the hardships in our class in the Jewish home. It's Torah Timecha. It's the way you saw your mother. It's what your mother did with you. And people who try to work with textbooks very often end up with weird solutions, with weird conclusions. I was invited by someone who's a Chozer B'tshuva, a very fine Jew. I admire him. I don't know if I'm fit to sit at the same table as him. People who make such changes in their life, it's admirable. So we sat together at the table, and he washes, and until we get all the kids to wash, and I wash, I see he's talking in between the washing and the amotzi. So I think to myself, he's not Sfaradi and he's not Yemenite, and the Ramah says you're not supposed to talk in between washing and amotzi. But there is an opinion that says it's okay. Okay, fine, so he could still make damotzi for me, but it's wrong. But I'm not going to say anything. I'm a guest in his house. He didn't ask me to come and be his rabbi. So I didn't say anything. I come to the table, and he asks me if I want this, that, and other thing. And I do my own thing. I go, whatever. I'm not going to talk. And then he makes damotzi, and I eat, and everyone eats. And afterwards, like a few minutes later, he says, I noticed you didn't talk between the washing and the damotzi. I said, right. He said, but it says in halacha you could talk. I said, there are Yemenites, there are people who have the custom that they could talk, but I think the Ramah brings that you're not supposed to talk between the washing and the hamotzi. So he says, yeah, but doesn't it say there you could say, pass me the salt, and this and other thing? I said, yeah, it does say. It says that if there's something that you need for the meal, so things that are absolutely necessary for the meal, if you say them, then halachically it's not considered a hefsek. That's not considered a halachic pause that you'd have to start from scratch. It doesn't say lechatchila you should just go talking whatever you want. It says things that are absolutely necessary for the meal. You need it now. Okay, so asking someone to pass it is like whatever you need to do in order to get the meal started. Fine, so you could do that. But that doesn't mean you should do that. So the guy actually learned and tried to get it right and decided this is what right means. Well, good for him. You know, I know it because I grew up with it. And then years later, I learned it. But you ask me where I know it from, I know it because I grew up with not talking between washing and making amotzi. I don't know it from the books. You try to learn a whole religion, a whole way of life from the books, you're going to end up with funny conclusions. So he lets his son walk around without a yarmulke because he says, you say the whole house is like Dalet Amos, that's why you could walk and wash your hands in the morning. So then he could walk around without a yarmulke because it's all like Dalet Amos. Okay, that's not right. It's not right chinuch for his kids. Whether the logic is right or wrong, we could argue with the logic too. But let's assume his logic is right. Do you see any other Jewish children walking around the house without a yarmulke? I don't see it. That's not the way a house is supposed to look. But it's not my job to tell him anything, right? He didn't bring me in to say things. He invited me as a guest. I'm very happy. It was a nice meal. Thank you very much. But there are endless examples where if a person is going to live by the book and he's not going to live by the norm, so then he's going to get it wrong. And the examples, you know, I gave you two, but there are many. And that's why it's important, more important than attending my Jewish home class, is to be a part of a Jewish home, to find a family or two that you're comfortable with, and then learn this Al Titosh Torah Timecha, learn what the norms of the house are. And with time, you'll also be able to ask. So Shlomo HaMelech says with regard to the Torah that you learned from your father or the Torah you learned from your mother, Koshrema libecha tamid. Shlomo HaMelech says, tie them to your heart constantly. Koshrema libecha tamid ondeim al gargeroticha. And adorn them on your throat. Meaning they should be something you think about. It should be something you talk about. And that's another point. People sometimes think you should talk divrei Torah at the table. They talk Lashon Hara and all kinds of nonsense and politics throughout the Shabbos table, and then they bang on the table and they say, now say Dvar Torah. Okay, good for them. It's nice. It's nice that they say Dvar Torah. But Chazal wanted that the Shabbos table should be a constant talk of Torah. That our life should be a life of Torah. And if you know Torah on a high level, it could be on a high level. And if you know Torah on a low level, it could be on a low level. And if your kids are little kids, so you talk on their level. So you tell them stories on their level. And you talk about Avraham Avinu's tent that had four entrances and all the guests he had and how it must have been difficult. Shlomo Amel says, Koshem ali b'chat tamid. They should always be tied on a person's heart, meaning they should always be within a person's thought. On dem al gargotecha, they should always be worn around the neck, which is a way of saying, that's what you should be talking about. And so the whole Shabbos table should be a table of Torah. It doesn't have to be that we talk only about the parasha. We could talk about Allah, we could talk about other things. There's nothing wrong if you guys want to talk about other things at the table. I also, at my Shabbos table, I interview each kid. What do I mean by that? Each kid knows they're going to have their opportunity when I'm going to ask them, who do you play with in Gan, and who do you sit next to, and who's picking on you this week, and who are you picking on this week, and which Ganana did you like, and which Ganana didn't you like, and what did you make in class, and what didn't you make, and part of the Shabbos table is also to hear where each one's holding and what their week was like. But I'm saying in a broader sense, Chazal wanted that our conversation in general, our conversation in our thought, revolve around Torah. Yeah. So I explained. I think that that's because that's something you learn from the mother, even though halachically it goes by the father. But that's like the mother's Torah. It's when the mother tells you that this is what you do. So.
So I understand like the concept that you pick it up from the mother, like what she's doing it and that. But I mean, if she came from a different household, I mean, she might have like different mitzvahim that she hasn't fully.
Technically, yeah. You're right. You're right. It's a good point. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
In terms of being bent by it, is it how often is it recommended to be by there? Is it with the?
So, when I was a youngster, I'm still a youngster, but when I was even younger, I did a little bit of entertainment. I was in. I did all kinds of sleight of hand tricks and stuff. So we had a rule that you always have to end the show when people are asking for more. Don't wait till they tell you to stop. You always have to stop when they're asking for more. I would say it's the same thing as a guest. You know, the fact that they tell you we want you more, that's a good sign. Don't push it to the point where they're not telling you we want more. When in doubt, less is more. I think, you know, different scenarios play themselves out differently. It's a little hard to give a rule. Meaning, if it's a family in the neighborhood, so it could be they're happy to see you every Shabbos or every other Shabbos for a meal or stuff like that. And a lot of it depends on their personality and your personality. But most people tend to overestimate the amount that their host wants them. Mm-hmm. And they should, I'm telling you, most people. That's what we find. And it's better to work the other way around. To find two families you go to, find three families you go to, and you don't have to learn everything from each family. You learn some things from one family and some things from another family. And I can tell you I did it too, even though Baruch Hashem I merited to grow up in a from home. I learned a lot from many families I went to. So you'll get a lot to learn from. How different can they be already? I don't know. You know, there's Temani and there's Temani. Chances are it's not going to work for you to be Temani. If they're a certain type of Temani, you know, being from Canada, right? I don't think it's going to be so natural for you to do a lot of things that Temanim do. And you probably won't be so comfortable if your wife does a lot of things that Temani wives do. So I think that there might be certain things that you could absorb from there, but I think it's a good idea to try to find homes that are more similar to the type of home you envision yourself building. But beggars can't be choosers. You know, you got to see what works. It's not always up to us. But if you could, I would. I think it is a good idea to try to find someone who's who resonates with the type of home you see yourself building. Someone say something? I didn't follow. Pasuk Chaf Bet. Bitalechacha tanche otach b'shochbecha tishmor alecha v'hakitzota hi tesichecha. This pasuk we say in every siyum, so you guys should know it so you don't mispronounce it. Bitalechacha, as you walk, tanche otach, the Torah should guide you. And that's a reference to life on this planet. And everything a person does, If he wants to know what's the honest and fair way to do it, he should look in the Torah. B'italechacha tancheotach. B'shochbecha tishmor alecha. When you lie down, the Torah will watch over you. So that could be understood as when you lie down at night or when a person lies down in the grave. V'akitzota, when you awaken, hitesichecha, the Torah is what's going to talk with you, so to speak. It's like your good friend, your good pal. V'akitzota, hitesichecha, when you awaken, it will talk with you. And that's the way the Torah should be. It should be our way of life and what we do and how we do and what we say. Chazal interpreted Vakitzota when you awaken in Tchiyat HaMetim, when you come back to life to be judged, Hitisichecha, the Torah will speak on your behalf. The Torah will make claims on your behalf. Vakitzota Hitisichecha. I often think, I wish I could have had a day or two to learn some Mishnayos by heart with Gilad Shalit, a little bit of Tanakh. Wherever a person is, if he has Torah, then he has things to let his mind work on. And Torah has limitless depth. You know a little bit of Torah, so you can find depth in that little bit of Torah. You know a lot of Torah, you can find depth in a lot of Torah. But every bit of Torah has limitless depth if you think about it, if you think deeply about it. The Torah is always ready to talk with you. And this is a habit that people can get into. It's a habit as far as a person's thought. The Brisker Rav used to stop his son when he was learning and send him to do errands. And his son once asked him, "Dad, why do you always stop me in the middle of my learning and send me to do these errands? Couldn't they wait an hour or two?" And his answer was, "Life is about having to stop. Life doesn't always give us the capacity to sit and focus. And I want you to get used to being focused as you're doing other things. Learn to think Torah as you're doing other things." So, I once was discussing with Rabbi Feinstein about whether I should stop my learning to go to a certain simcha, or do I really owe it to the guy to go? So he looked at me in bewilderment. He said, "Is it such a big bittul Torah? You're not going to think Torah the whole way there and back?" He looked at me like, "Is it such a big deal? You know, so you review things by heart as you travel, no?" What do you have? Why do you think you have to stop learning just because you're traveling somewhere for a simcha? So that's a habit that every person has to get into. That even when he's traveling, even when he's lying down, even when he awakens, and if you want to retain your learning, then this is a very good way to retain it. I find that the things I remember best are the things that I reviewed as I was falling asleep at night. If you try to review stuff that you learned today as you're falling asleep, it could be Mishnah, Tanakh, Halacha, whatever it is, if you're reviewing it as you fall asleep, that's going to stay with you. And a person can also review things as he's walking. The simple meaning of the pasuk is that the Torah is the guide for life. The Torah is the guide when you walk. When you lie down and you're not living the life of Torah, you're going to sleep, so then the Torah does its end of the deal, it watches over you. But right away when you get up, you start talking Torah again. And that's what the famous song the Ibn Ezra wrote. It says, "I go to sleep with the fond memories of the dating we had before I went to sleep. And I awaken on the memories of our close relationship we had last night." He was talking about the Torah. He says, it's like a love song. It's like a relationship. Yeah.
Something I kind of parallel. In terms of recording what we've learned, is it appropriate at our stage to write a blog on what we're studying?
I don't know what would go into that blog, so I don't know the answer to that.
Anything that we learned that week?
I don't know, again, I don't know what would go into it, and I don't know who would read it. Meaning, the concern is to start publishing something when you don't know it well enough, but you're still learning it, might be room for others to err. On the other hand, maybe these people wouldn't learn anything else, and like this, they're learning something. So it's a little hard to call that. I don't know how to call that, Chad. I don't know.
I guess it would have to be something that's not fresh.
One of
No idea. I don't know.
I guess part of it would be that it's sometimes hard to share my thoughts with my parents on what they get a little involved and learn verbally.
So that's a great idea. That's a great idea. If it's for people like that, if it's sometimes you have a following. You have your relatives, your friends, your parents, your uncles, your grandparents. They're never going to listen to any shiur. But if you start writing a blog on what you're learning here, they'll read it. So why not? I think I would do that, yes. I wouldn't invest too much time in it. You got to do your own learning. But I think it is beneficial. It'll also help you clarify what you've learned. And they'll question it. And then you'll have to clarify it some more. Yeah?
Would it be a solution to have a disclaimer at the start saying it's purely my opinion? And then have some feedback so you can comment on the same page?
I don't think the disclaimer is enough. Because at the end of the day, even if you write a disclaimer from people's perspective, you know, they could open up the internet and see the chief rabbi's shir and your shir, and they don't know the difference. A lot of people have no way of gauging how much you know and how much someone else knows. So I don't think the disclaimer is enough. I would also add that you have to be prepared to sometimes say, I don't know the answer to that. And you have to be prepared to sometimes say, I heard the answer, I understood the answer, and I don't know how to put it in writing. You have to come to Machon Meir, come learn here. I'm serious, I'm not joking. Saying you're not always going to be able to articulate things that you understand. And sometimes that can be frustrating if people are questioning what you wrote. So I think you have to be prepared to say that. Yeah, I learned it, I understand it, and if you want to come, learn it too. But I can't really express it here. Pasuk Chaf Gimel, Shlomo Amer says, the famous Pasuk, Kiner mitzvah v'tora ohor v'derech chayim tochechot musar. Ner mitzvah, the mitzvos that we do are like a candle, they illuminate the world for us. V'torah, but the Torah that we learn, that's all, that's like the sun shining. V'derech chayim tochechot musar. And when people rebuke or help a person veer onto the right path, it's not only about the right path, it's also derech chaim, they're veering him onto the path of life. And we have a lot of students whose relatives will testify to that. That derech chaim tochechot musar. Going onto a moral path, coming into Machon Meir and learning how to build their life correctly, that was not only a path of morality, it was also a path to life. The stories are limitless. I mean, you guys probably know at least as many stories as I do. But I'll tell you a short story. We had a student who came here because he needed a free bed. A student who came here because he heard that in Machon Meir, if you say you want to learn about Judaism, you get a meal and you get a bed. And to make a long story short, today he's not doing drugs anymore. And I don't know if he's still in the army or he's out of the army, but he's Baruch Hashem, an observant Jew. He puts on tefillin every day and he's looking to build his life and get a job. And he went from being a drug dealer to being a good Torah observant Jew, and he's on his way onward. And there are more stories like that. I remember a few years ago, I came here to daven Friday night, and at the end of davening, when they sing Adon Olam, I snuck out the back door. I didn't want to talk to anyone. I knew everyone was waiting at home for the meal, and I get to the light up at the corner. And there's a guy from the yeshiva standing there. So I realized he wasn't at Meiriv with me that night. So he looks at me and he's got tears in his eyes and he says, I only came to Machon Meir for a free bed. And now they're changing my whole life around. So I said, who's forcing you to do anything? So he looks at me and he says, the truth. So I said, what'd you want when you came? He said, you have to understand, before I came to Machon Meir, I'd been in jail, and he starts telling me his whole life story, how many times he's been in jail, how many people he robbed, how many drugs he'd been dealing. I never knew all of this. Today, I had the good fortune to circumcise one of his kids. He's married. He has a beautiful home. He has a job. He learns Torah part of the day. He works part of the day. He didn't come here to do any of that. I never asked him why he came. But I have my doubts, because at one point he told me that he robbed everyone he knew in his life. He said he can't think of anyone he knew he didn't steal from. So I made a mental note. Let's wonder whether we bring him home for a meal. Right? But no, I'm joking. Seriously, he was in my home numerous times. But you ask yourself, then why did he come here? Just for the bed? Or for the loot? I don't know. But today that's not where he's holding. Derech Chaim Tochechot Musar. The way of Torah is not only a way of morality, it's also a way of life, true life. And when a person is off the path of Torah, so then his focus is off. His focus could be on making the money, his focus could be on achieving different things in life, but at the end of the day, when he suddenly opens his eyes and realizes, Tochechot Musar, this isn't the right way, this isn't the moral way, and then he finds his way back to that Ner Mitzvah V'Torah Or, to the candle of Torah, to the lamp of Torah, of the mitzvos in the Torah, he finds himself on a complete path of life, on a Derech Chaim. When people ask me about Machon Meir, so I say, although we don't knowingly take people who need rehabilitation from drugs, we say that requires a rehabilitation center, but if you ask me, Machon Meir is really a rehabilitation center. Why is it a rehabilitation center? We're not dealing with drugs or drinking. Right, we're dealing with life, rehabilitating people. So people learn how to focus on life and build a productive life. Our goal is that you guys move on. We have no goal that guys stay here. You know, many other places want you to stay, get another degree, learn more, pay tuition for another 15 years. Our goal is to move, you should move on. From our perspective, we've succeeded when you've moved on to lead productive lives. But that's Derech Chaim, because Torah is a path of life. It's about living. It's about living a moral life. It's about living a balanced life, but it's about living life. Says Shlomo HaMelech, Lishmocha mei eshet ra'a mei chelkat lashon nochriya. The Torah will watch you from a bad wife, from a bad woman. And again, whenever Shlomo speaks about women in Mishle, it has dual meaning. It has the literal meaning. If you learn Torah and you know how to apply Torah correctly, then hopefully you'll end up with a good wife. Hopefully. Not necessarily. Big rabbis had bad wives. You never have a guarantee in life. But hopefully it'll help protect you. But the deeper meaning, that whenever Shlomo HaMelech is talking about the bad woman, he's talking about bad philosophy. He's talking about paganism. He's talking about things that could lead a person to the most cruel acts in the name of religion, in the name of philosophy. And that's the eshet ra. That's the bad wife in Mishle. Mechelkaat lashon nochriya, from the portion, from the slippery slope, the seduction of lashon nochriya, of the tongue that is foreign. Which again, the simple meaning is it will save a person from going with a woman of ill repute. Chelkat lashon nochriya, that foreign tongue that speaks so smoothly. On the deeper meaning, this is the seduction of philosophies that at first glance seem like they're pleasant, like they're going to afford a person an enjoyable life, but the truth is it's a slippery slope. It's not in a person's best interest. And so Shlomo HaMelech says, Al tachmod yofya bilvavehecha. Don't even desire her beauty in your heart. Sometimes a person says, what's wrong? You know, I'm only thinking about her. No, Shlomo HaMelech says, you think about things, you end up in a certain place. In driving, when they teach you how to drive, so one of the first things they tell you is that you end up driving where you look. That's the nature of a person. So you got to look forward if you want to drive forward. The same thing is true about our thoughts. And if you keep thinking about something, then you're always moving yourself closer to doing it. So Shlomo HaMelech says, don't even desire her beauty in your heart. And don't let her take you in with her batting of her eyelashes. Don't be drawn. Because for the desire of a prostitute, a person ends up impoverished to the point that he doesn't even have a loaf of bread. What is a prostitution? It's a cheap, quick thrill. And when a person doesn't have the self-control to save up and build something of value, so then he's going to end up losing his money in a logical way. Chazal say this is an amulet, that a person who goes for prostitution will end up impoverished. It's a spiritual thing. But the truth is, without looking at it from the spiritual thing, Chazal interpret it spiritually. We can take it simply, that when a person is going to go for the short term, so then he's never going to save up money, and he is going to find himself without even money to buy himself a loaf of bread. And the truth is that sums up the book of Mishlei. Rav Sadia Gaon writes in his introduction to Mishlei that if you want to sum up the concepts that we talk about in a nutshell, that's what the Torah trains us for, to lead a balanced life where we invest, and ultimately we get much more for our investment, but you have to be in it for the long term. So that's a recurring theme in Judaism. That's from Adam Arishon. Adam Arishon was supposed to eat the forbidden fruit in a few hours had he waited. He was supposed to make Kiddush on the grapes, but he didn't. He ate it right away. David HaMelech was supposed to marry Bathsheba, but in a few days or months, it was supposed to happen, but he took her a little bit too early. He was correct in being attracted to the forbidden fruit. There was something unique about it. It was supposed to be used for Kiddush. There was something unique about Bathsheba. She was exactly the right wife for him, but he took her too early. The Torah trains us that in the long term you wait and then you get the better. It's not even in the same ballpark. A person that is always looking for cheap thrills. We once had a guy who was contemplating being a student in this yeshiva. We had two guys with the same story. Almost the same story. And I cried bitterly over both of them. They both came here and they said, I remember a third guy. This is a recurring story. Guys who came in here and said, I know that I'll have a much better life if I marry a frum girl and build a house according to the values of the Torah. But I'm used to living life differently. I'm used to going to bars. I'm used to being promiscuous. And I'm not sure. The three people I'm thinking of never ended up as students here. They all came to check it out. They all said they recognize this is a better way of life. And two of the three I'm still in touch with. And they're still promiscuous. And they're still out there. And what's going to be in 10 years and in 20 years? They won't have a family. They won't have a wife. It's a temptation. It's out there. It's always been there. Shlomo HaMelech says, there's a reason why on the simple level, Shlomo keeps warning us about running after the cheap thrills. Because throughout world history, there's always been that temptation. But at the end of the day, Shlomo HaMelech says a person ends up without money to buy a loaf of bread, and a person doesn't build a future, and ultimately he regrets it.
Any short advice regarding your thoughts or long advice? I hear it, and it's really hard to think
So the question was asked, if Shlomo HaMelech is telling us not to think in that direction, so how does one do that? So there are a few answers to that, and we'll go one at a time. Number one, we have to realize that the Torah says lo tachmot, do not desire, do not covet your friend's wife, right? Do not covet your friend's money, your friend's asset, your friend's home. So the Torah holds us responsible for our thoughts. So obviously we can control them, right? If I have a mitzvah that way, if it's one of the Ten Commandments, then obviously I can control it. Chazal tell us that every single day, every single normal person has an improper thought. So that's normal. It's part of being a normal person. And maybe in today's day and age, it's harder than it ever was before. Because everywhere you go, everything you see. You can't stand at a bus stop without seeing immodest pictures. But we have to realize that there's a difference between the first second and the second second. meaning the first second a thought pops into a person's mind or a person sees something that arouses a thought in him, so that's beyond his control. At that second, the person has a choice to make. Is he going to harp on that thought, or is he going to think about something else? Is he going to distract himself? And the first key to controlling one's thought is realizing that. That the fact that I started thinking something doesn't mean I have to continue thinking something. Now the temptation is very big. The pasuk says, Tov marei einayim me'alach nafesh, that what a person fantasizes about is even sweeter than the thing itself. Tov marei einayim, what we see, what we imagine, what we fantasize, is even better me'alach nafesh than actually doing the thing itself. So the temptation is very real. You know, in fantasy land, everything can happen. And then some. So there's good reason why a person would want to fantasize, because A, it's much better than the real thing, and B, like the Rambam says, like the Gemara says, this is something which on the surface we have a hard time considering a sin. A person tells himself afterwards, what did I do wrong? A, no one knows what I did. B, I was just thinking. It's not that way. But the Rambam says, one of the reasons it's hard to do tshuva on this is because it's hard for us to conceptualize, it's hard for us to really realize that this is wrong. So that's why we go back to the point we just said, that, remember, it's one of the Ten Commandments. It's serious, right? It's one of the key points that Torah had to give us, and we can understand why, because every person you see out there that committed adultery and did every other thing you could see that's wrong, almost every person, it was premeditated. No, you know, sometimes it's not premeditated. Sometimes things land on a person. But most of the time, a person, it was premeditated. So our thoughts are very, very important. They define where we are. Now, Chazal described to us two formulas for dealing with the Yetzer Hara. Chazal said, if you bumped into this derelict, the Yetzer Hara, drag him into the academy. So Chazal over there, we're talking about the external Yetzer Hara. The person has to know you're going to be in certain areas, and the external stimuli present a Yetzer Hara. So stay away from that. Go to Beis Medrash. A guy says, when I sit on the internet, I'm tempted to do things that are improper. Okay, so sit on the internet in the Beis Medrash. Not 2 o'clock in the morning when no one's around, right? A person should realize where his pitfalls are and try to bring them into his domain, into a place where that will ensure that he does what's right. And a person should try to avoid temptation. It's up to a person where he goes, how he goes. Then Chazal said, if a person sees that his desire is getting the better of him, so that's not talking about any external stimuli. He's sitting in his bedroom, he's sitting in the Beis Medrash. You could be anywhere and the mind starts wandering. You don't need any external stimuli. It's just God made us that way, that we can do good enough on our own. And we'll pick up here in 1 second. So we were saying that there's also an internal Yetzirah, which is our own imagination, which could happen anywhere. And about that, Chazal said, "Im ra'adam sheitzom tiber alav yergiz alav yetzer tov." If a person sees that his desire for doing something wrong is getting aroused from within and it's overcoming him, so then Chazal say, arouse the desire for good. Be productive, think positive thoughts, think about the mitzvahs you can do. A person has a lot of areas which a person can think about, and he could focus his mind on the positive. The Rambam gives us a rule. The Rambam says, "She'ena yetzel tokef ela lalev ha'panuy min ha'chokhmah." Desire attacks the heart when it is clean of wisdom. Meaning, you could have a very smart person, but it's when he lets his mind wander. The Mishnah says in Ksubos that when we marry, there is an intrinsic understanding in the marriage that there are certain things that are the husband's responsibilities and certain things that are the wife's responsibilities. He has to put bread on the table. He has to. There are certain things he has to do. There are certain things she has to do. And what happens if she brings maids with her? She comes from a wealthy family. So then for maid number one, she could say, I don't do the dishes. For if she brings in two maids, she could say, I don't do the laundry. If she brings in three maids, she could say, I don't do the beds. You know, the Mishnah goes through, I'm exaggerating, but the Mishnah goes through how many maids she brings with her. And for each maid that she brings with her, she could say, you know, I brought you a maid into the marriage. I don't have to do this much of the work that's ordinarily a wife's responsibility. What happens when she brings in a whole battalion of maids? Could she say, now don't ask me for anything. You want a drink, ask the maid. You want to know where the milk is, ask the maid. I don't got to do anything. Mishnah says, the husband could tell her, honey, I want you to sew me a jacket. And she'll say, I'll get the maid to sew you a jacket. And he'll say, no, I want you to sew me a jacket. So the Mishnah says, why is that so? Because Habatala Hashiamun, when a person is bored, when he has nothing to do with his time, Mevili de Zima. That leads to adultery, that leads to everything that's improper. Because if you got nothing to do, so where's your mind gonna wander? Not to positive things, it's gonna wander to negative things. So that's the nature of everyone. The Mishnah even says so. The husband can insist, I want you to have a job. I want you to work. And she'll say, but what do you need? I'll give you whatever you want from my maids. And he could say, what I need is for you to be busy. And that's a legitimate claim that a husband can make, and a wife can make the same claim, obviously. The idea is that a person who's bored is going to end up getting into trouble. And trouble over here, the nature of humanity is that this is one of the big areas of trouble that are always tempting us. Men and women alike. So, when we say, how does a person overcome the improper thoughts that plague a person? So, point number one, we said, let's realize that the first second is, so to speak, beyond our control, but the second second is within our control. And the person should alter his thoughts. Point number two, we said, a person should avoid places which will arouse improper thoughts within him. And we said that could be places and that could be situations. Point number three, we said a person should realize it's normal, but it's our responsibility to overcome it and overcome it from within by thinking positive thoughts. Point number four, we said boredom brings to it. And we said boredom. When you have free time, you have nothing to do with your time. So a person that daydreams, you know, that's where his mind wanders. And I'd like to add one more point, and that is that at the end of the day, it is also a habit. Meaning a person could get into the habit of letting his mind go in this direction, or a person could get into the habit that the second it starts, he leads his mind to a different direction. The fact that it will start, well, at certain times in life it's more difficult, and certain times of life it's easier. And that's where we'll add one more point, which is a point in your favor. Chazal said that the nature of a human being is that normal people, after they reach puberty, are going to constantly have their thoughts wandering in that direction. And it's going to be an everlasting struggle to overcome that. And that's why Chazal wanted people to get married relatively young. Because Chazal said it's very hard to maintain clean thoughts when a person isn't married. Once a person is married, Chazal said, pat besalo. It's like a person that has bread in his basket. The Mishnah says that when they'd send the person out with the goat to Azazel on Yom Kippur, they'd always send him out with bread in the basket. And then it's recorded that he never ate it. All the years he traveled out into the desert with the goat, he never ate it. Why? Because pat besalo. Because if you know you have bread in the basket, you're less hungry. So Chazal say it's the same thing with marriage. Once a person's married, even though there are times in the marriage where every month the woman has her period, and then the couple spends 2 weeks where they're not touching and they're not together, but the fact that he knows that in 2 weeks he's going to be with his wife, that's called pat besalo. He's got bread in his basket. And so it's easier for a person to overcome his improper thoughts and to keep his mind focused on the positive. We should also remember that Rambam, that one of the hardships is that we don't view it as sin, and that makes it hard for us to do tshuva. We should remember, no, it's one of the Ten Commandments. And then and then that also helps us overcome it, because like everything in life, you have to really want to overcome it in order to overcome it. And remember, deep down inside, none of us really want to overcome it. You got to go really deep down inside to that pure place in the soul which it connects to God, that really wants to overcome it. But Chazal said, it's the nature of the beast. Yeah, I think it was first, yeah.
So you were talking about the Mishnah and the Lahad that says the husband can tell the woman that she must do something. So can we say that can be by bad husband to force the wife to do something she doesn't want slash like?
We have many halachot which can be misapplied, and that's where you need a court, and you need a chief rabbi or a king. You need someone who's going to be able to read between the lines. The halacha is the system. Then you need the human being, the human intervention, to read between the lines, and that's the rabbi's job.
So what about the situation that you said that it's true that many times our feelings are above our heads, so we don't have control of ourselves. Is there any moment that we should make our feelings more... worldly,
they
should be more present in us,
and
not so much the machshava, not so much the logical side.
I didn't understand anything.
I'm asking, is there any moment in our life that we should allow our feelings to be more, active, and not so much the logical part, logical side of it?
Still not understanding.
Sometimes we are controlled by the feelings, right? Is there a moment in our life that we should say, okay, so the head should be turned off for a couple of minutes, and the feelings should have total control of ourselves? Got it?
Act instinctively instead of logically.
I think that Chazal wanted us to know to balance logic and feeling, thought and emotion. And I think part of that balance is also knowing when to let the emotion run forward, but I don't think it means to let the emotion run unchecked. For example, a person is at a wedding. So you'll tell him, every minute you should think about how big a mitzvah you're performing. No. You tell him, go enjoy the wedding and dance and be happy. But that doesn't mean you should step on the guy who's next to you, you should step on his toes. Use your head. And you should also, at the same time that the prime actor in your life is your emotion, the mind also has to play a little bit to ensure that what you're doing isn't stepping on other people, isn't doing things prohibitively. So I think that yes, the Torah expects us to have times in our life where the emotion takes center stage, times of extreme joy, times of extreme sadness, etc. But even at those times, I think the halacha did want the mind to have a certain check, that you don't go overboard. The Torah tells us a person is supposed to mourn when he loses his relative, he's supposed to weep, he's supposed to tear his garment, he's supposed to grow his hair. There are certain things he's supposed to do. He's not supposed to inflict harm, bodily harm on himself. He's not supposed to scratch himself. He's not supposed to cause himself to bleed or pull out his hairs. So you see, the Torah tells you, on the one hand, be normal, let the emotions express themselves, and obviously the emotion is what's taking center stage at that time. The halacha tells him he's absolved from his obligation to bench and do many, many mitzvot in the Torah, because we realize now is the time he has to focus on what he's doing. At the same time, the halacha says that we're not going to let him murder him, we're not going to let him even hurt himself. There are certain things that we say the mind does have to remain as the check on the emotions. So yes, I think the halacha expects a person to be an emotional person, and the emotions should come to play, but I don't think that there's ever a time that the halacha says just let go and just let the emotions run the show. I don't think so. I think the center stage, yes, but not complete control. Fair enough? Yeah.
So you're saying that with regards to controlling our thoughts, we should remember that Al-Tahmod is one of the Ten Commandments, right?
I'm trying to give a practical tool that might help some people realize that it's a serious prohibition, yes.
Right, but Al-Tahmod refers to something which already belongs to another person, but in many instances which you mentioned, it could be something which is out there but doesn't really belong to anybody yet, and therefore wouldn't fall under Tachmod.
Right, granted. I just meant that Lo Tachmod reminds us that the Torah expects us to have control over our thoughts.
With regards to other people's property.
Fine. That's true, but then the true source for this prohibition is other verses which are not as clear to the layman. There are other verses which prohibit looking at someone of the opposite gender in a certain way, etc. Yes.
In respect, are we supposed to be looking at each other as Am Yisrael? Like, okay, maybe this Joe Schmo or Plani Shmarani, that I don't know, he's also Jewish. Can he also be like a relative of mine, and that I shouldn't be looking at his wife either, because this is my neighbor, this is my cousin, whatever. Is that too far? I feel like within like the Am of Israel, that we should be looking at everybody as this is also like my property, so to speak, with respect to this
fine. Fine. I like he correctly pointed out, I didn't mean specifically someone else's wife. I meant also, you know, you're walking in the street, you're not supposed to be looking immodestly at women, even if the woman's not married.
What I'm saying is, this is the daughter of another Jew.
Fine. That's why I'm not ostracizing her. I'm just saying we should be modest in the way we look at people. I think that there's a balance there, no?
No, that's what I'm also saying.
Okay.
Since we're talking about that situation, it's very good when you go to a supermarket and whether it's a man or a woman, it's a cashier. So, and sometimes we need to cheer them up. Would it be a problem to cheer up like a lady that she's working for many hours, taking out many clients, angry clients, and sometimes there are certain sikhot that they're not so good. It's when they're allowed to laugh, but still.
I think there's a gentle balance there, but I think there's definitely room for that. I think that the correct approach is to know that balance between saying good morning and thank you very much. And I know you guys must have had a long day. It's the end of the day. You're probably waiting for Shabbos. It's throwing in a good word. And I appreciate how quickly you took care of my order. I think that's one angle. And then I think there's flirting, which is crossing over a certain line. So where the balance lies is, I think it's hard to draw a line. But I think that every person has to be aware of it. You should just be aware that different societies have different social norms. Meaning, some societies, if you call up and the wife answers the phone and you say, "Hi, how are you?" that's normal. In other societies, if you do that, they look to you like you fell off the roof. Where are you coming from? Why are you asking my wife how she's doing? I'm telling you something I experienced. I had a very good friend, a Hasidic friend, when I was a teenager in high school. And I once called him, he wasn't there. And I tried to be like, you know, just polite on the phone. And he came to me afterwards like all upset. Really? Like, at first I thought he was joking. He looked so upset that I was sure he was joking. And after like a minute or two, I realized he's not joking. He's very serious. Okay? Different societies, different social norms.
So isn't it that we should ask for shalom of the husband to the wife and vice versa?
You have to know the norm of each society. Yeah.
If you're saying that your friend was very upset about you asking how his wife was, I think it says more about your friend than you, because she didn't do it like on purpose, and he's maybe he's too upset about his. Some people don't know like their borders until everything go. Like I think there should be like just maybe it's a social matter as well. Like if you get, I don't criticize your friend obviously, but if somebody's like.
You should just understand, he comes from a society that when they sit for the Shabbos table, the women don't sit at the table.
Yeah.
The women sit in the kitchen. So, okay. I didn't realize that either. You know, we were friends, we volunteered at the same place together. So one time I had to call. There are places that take certain things to an extreme.
Yeah.
You can agree, you can disagree, but you have to know how to play by the rules a little bit. Shlomo Melech continues with a very scary line. He says, "Ve'eshet ish nefesh yekarah tatzud," and a married woman can entrap even a very precious soul. Meaning, even someone who hitherto was righteous and pious, what we would call a precious soul, Shlomo Melech says, don't assume that falling with committing adultery is beyond any person. Shlomo Melech is talking, teaching every one of us. Shlomo Melech says, "Nefesh yikara tatzud," a precious soul, an unusual soul, gets entrapped with this sin, and so a person has to watch himself. And now, Shlomo Melech is the son of Bathsheba, who was married by David under questionable circumstances. So we have a tradition, and the psukim tell us that ultimately it was permitted. That's why God approved of it and anointed King Solomon the continuation. But Shlomo Melech is telling us an interesting point for him to be saying. He's saying, don't assume because you're a big tzaddik or anything else that it's beyond you. Even a very precious soul could become entrapped in this sin of an eshet ish, a married woman, a sin where the Torah says one should rather give up their life than transgress this. So what does that tell us practically? That tells us to be careful in the laws of Yichud. That tells us to be careful in the laws of Negiya. We have laws where the Torah says, don't put yourself in a situation where something could happen. So you'll tell me, well, I'd never think it would happen. Right, Shlomo Melech says, right, you'd never think it would happen. Very pious people have fallen. And so Shlomo Melech says, watch it. Hayachte ish, ish bechiko, uvgadav, lo tisarafna. Can a person take a fire in his garments and his clothes won't get burnt? Can you hold a fire, take a lit match, put it in your pocket, and your clothes won't get burnt? Im yalech ish ala gechalim v'raglav lo tikavena. Does a person walk on coals and not burn his feet? Kein haba eleshet reyehu lo yinakeh kol hanogeh ba. So too, anyone who does commit adultery with his friend's wife, he won't come clean. He's holding fire in his garments. And Shlomo Melech is running now. This will take us to the conclusion of this chapter. He says, "Lo yavuzu laganav ki yignov, limalein nafsho ki yirav." When people see a person who stole, when they see someone who, at the end of the day, he needed the food, so he stole it because he was hungry. And even that, people don't look lightly upon. They say thief, and they're willing to put him in prison. V'nimtza yeshalem shivatayim et kol hon beito yitein. When he's caught, they tax him, they make him pay. He could lose all his wealth. Why did he steal the loaf of bread? Because he was hungry. Noef isha chasar lev. How much more so? Someone who commits adultery, he takes his friend's wife. That's a person who has no heart. He's not doing it because he's hungry. Mashchit nafsho hu ya'asena. Someone who is ready to destroy his soul, that's who does it. Negave kalon yimtzaha. And ultimately what he'll find is he will find shame, he will be derided. V'cherpato lo timache. And his shame will never be wiped off. It'll never pass. It's interesting. I live in a community, I used to live in a community, my parents, I grew up in a community where a very public figure, someone who had a very high position in the government there, in the local government, was caught, I don't remember, I was a kid at the time. I don't think she was a married woman, I don't know. I mean, maybe he was just cheating on his wife. And they removed him from his post and everything. What? I mean, compared to adultery, look, cheating on his wife is wrong. It's morally incorrect. It could be a biblical prohibition, but he doesn't have to give up his life for it. You know, a guy that goes with a young girl in the office, so it's wrong, it's biblically prohibited, it's a lot of terrible things, but it's not adultery.
Okay,
you know, adultery is that the woman's married. Halachically, adultery is with a married woman. If a guy is married, so he's cheating on his wife when he's doing it, it's wrong of him. It's probably quite a few biblical prohibitions, but it's still not Yorek Valyavar, more than likely. I mean, if the girl's single, if it's it's a terrible thing to do. I'm not going to belittle it, but it's still not adultery. Two different things. So I don't remember the details of this story, but it was interesting that everyone knew it and no one forgets it. I was a kid. 10 years, 15 years have passed since then. At least I still remember. I remember the name. I remember everything. Shlomo HaMelech says the shame never gets wiped away. V'chirpato lo timacheh. Decades after David HaMelech had whatever he had with Bathsheba, people remembered it. There are things people don't forget. So Shlomo HaMelech says, what? To this day. Right. To this day, David HaMelech begged Hashem, it shouldn't be written. But it's written. So Shlomo HaMelech says, just like a person can't handle a fire in his clothing without burning himself, so too a person who commits adultery, his shame will never be wiped. Kikina chamat gahavel, because the anger of a husband is zealous, it's the desire for revenge. Velo yachmol biyom nakam, and the husband, when he catches him, he will do whatever he can to take revenge from him, and he's never going to forget, and he won't have any pity on him when he can take revenge from him. Lo yisa b'nei chol kohofer, the husband won't agree to take any payoff. He's not going to agree to forgive for anything. Velo yove ki tal b'shochad, and as much as you try to bribe him, he won't agree. He will ensure that the full force of the law, the full weight of everything he could hold against you, he will hold against you, and he will ensure that whatever he can, he will do against you. So Shlomo HaMelech says, obviously the Torah prohibits it, but Shlomo HaMelech says, realize that it is an action which logically is not worth doing. No one's going to look at it lightly, and so the intelligent thing is that use the Torah and the mitzvot to protect yourself from a bad woman, from the smooth tongue that could cause you to slip. And don't even look that way. If you look and you admire and you think about the beauty, so then you should realize that those are the first steps that lead a person to sin. And when a person does sin, so if he's sinning with a zonah, with a woman of ill repute, so then he can find himself impoverished to the point where he has no bread. And if it's a married woman, so you should realize that those are sins which even precious people, even people who were on a high level earlier, they've fallen on that sin, and that's a sin which can totally destroy a person, like handling fire within his clothing.